Good morning. I'm opening this meeting of the House Committee on Revenue, January 31st. Following the agenda that's been posted and published, we'll just take things in order. I'm opening a work session, possible bill introduction. Mr. Alanac, what do we have in front of us?
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. In OLS, there are five drafts, but I believe the intent is to only introduce four of them, so I will just describe the four.
Thank you.
The first one is LC 2068, and each of these four bills would require LRO to study a different topic. So LC 2628 would require LRO to study the impacts of connecting to federal law for the income tax, basically studying the impacts of the impact or how we connect to federal law for the income tax. LC 2630 would require us to study the effectiveness of income tax deductions and how they achieve their policy goals. So that would kind of extend upon the tax credit process. And then LC 2650 requires us to study the effectiveness of property tax exemptions. So it's analogous to the prior one, just on the property tax side. And then 2910 would require us to study the current design, effectiveness and current design of the estate tax. So again, those four LCs are 2628, 2630, 2650, and 2910.
Thank you. Four study bills. Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that the committee accept for introduction the four bills that, as described by staff.
Thank you. Is there discussion on the motion? Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just on, just for a little more information. It sounds like from the language of those bills, what we're looking for, what this would be looking for is similar to the way that LRO regularly reviews and assesses tax credits and kind of other parts of the revenue system. It sounds like this is specifically making requests slash calling out for that kind of analysis, but for other areas of the tax code. Is that
correct?
Your impression as well?
Correct.
Okay.
Yes, specific slices of how we do things and how it works.
And if I may, my background, having been involved at the national legislature, always makes me think this, which is, do we actually need a law to do this? Or can we just, is it something we can just ask or require LRO to do as a committee without? I just don't know.
It doesn't specifically require a law. We can, when we get to the end of the session and when we get to the interim, we work for the legislature, so we're employees of the legislature, and the committee can direct us to do various studies. During my time here, we've done it both ways, where occasionally it's formalized. It's a little more formal in terms of a law and the specifics laying it out.
Gotcha.
That as opposed to direction. So okay. In a pure sense, the answer is no. In practice, we've done it both ways.
Okay, thank you. That's what I was going to say. This sounds like it would more formalize it and make it kind of part of the regular, this is what LRO does, is do a research and analysis regularly on all these elements of the revenue system. Okay, thank you.
Additional discussion. Are there objections to the motion?
Madam Chair, I don't particularly have an objection to the motion, but I would like to have an understanding of what they are more than a three-line opening comment. And I fully support this, whether there are laws or direction too, but I'd like to have a better understanding of the issue.
Yes,
Representative. Are we just introducing the bills, and then the bills will go to the speaker's desk and then go through the process?
Okay.
So this is just,
Then I'm good with that.
Okay.
So.
Yes.
Good point. Then
we're
if
not passing them with you.
Then if we schedule a hearing, then we'll hear about it.
Okay.
Good. Thank you. Are there objections? Motion passes. Thank you. I'm closing that work session. Now, we will begin the public hearing, and I don't have any information that would suggest that I do bills in a different order other than what's posted. So, can I open a public hearing on all three simultaneously, or must I do them individually?
The topics are a little bit different, so you probably...
So, I'm just going to do them one at a time. I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2101, Partnership and Partner Audit Procedures. Yep. So anyone who needs to come to the table, please do it now.
Would you want me to go ahead and introduce them?
Please do.
Okay. So good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2101 in front of you is a bill that was introduced on behalf of the governor for Department of Revenue. And what the bill's doing is it's establishing a partnership and partner audit procedures for the Department of Revenue that would be in conformity with the federal centralized partnership audit regime. So there's a little information in the SMS in the background. Back in 2015, Congress passed the Bipartisan Budget Act, the BBA, and among other things done in that act, one of the changes was replacing the existing law and structure of dealing with audits of large partnerships. So there are changes made at the federal level, and then what you have in front of your House Bill 2101 are making changes here in Oregon, aligning in many ways with those federal changes.
Thank you.
Good morning.
The first name we have is Deanna Mack.
Sorry.
And the second is Nikki Dope. Is that you? Great.
Good morning, Madam Chair. For the record, Deanna Mack with Department of Revenue, and I'm here today to talk to you about our legislative concept, House Bill 2101, which Kyle introduced as aligning us to federal law. Federal law and regulations on IRS treatment of partnership audit adjustments have changed. Current Oregon statutes and rules do not align with the new federal treatment and create an administrative burden not only on us, on the department, to assess those federal partnership adjustments at the state level, but also for taxpayers to comply. So to understand why we're asking you to change this bill, I thought it would be good for us to share some background on the federal partnership audit procedures over the years. So partnerships are generally not subject to tax. Instead, the partners are. In 1982, Congress enacted the Unified Partnership Audit and Litigation Procedures as part of the Tax Equity and Fiscal Responsibility Act, also known as TEFRA. The basic point of TEFRA was to treat all partners in a partnership consistently when there was an audit of a partnership. Before TEFRA, different partners in the same partnership might get treated differently in different audits or federal court proceedings involving the same partnership items. To achieve more consistency, TEFRA provided direction on IRS audits and related activities involving the treatment of partnership items and other affected items at the partnership level. TEFRA affected all partnerships other than certain very small ones or certain electing large partnerships, which has now since been repealed with the CPAR. Under TEFRA, federal adjustments to partnership items ultimately were still taken into account at the individual partner level. Again, the partnership did not pay the tax, only the partners paid. So Oregon generally adopts the IRC's definition of federal taxable income, and like the IRS, Oregon taxes partners, not the partnerships. So in the TEFRA era, if the IRS made adjustments to partnership items of a partnership, and that partnership happened to also have Oregon source income, a partner in that partnership would generally would report those adjustments to Oregon and pay tax or seek a refund for that partner's own share, right? So over the last couple of decades, there's been a dramatic increase in the number of partnerships that are out there. So they may have hundreds of thousands of partners today. So like Kyle said, in 2015, the Bipartisan Budget Act repealed the TEFRA Act and replaced them with a set of partnership rules now known as the Centralized Partnership Audit Regime, or CPAR. During 2018, Congress made certain technical amendments to CPAR, and the IRS released final regulations that address many effects of the CPAR. So certain partnerships, those that have a small number of partners and provide the IRS the identity of those partners, are now allowed to elect out of the CPAR regime. Those partnerships that elect out of CPAR are not affected by House Bill 2101, so things still go to the partners. For those partners subject to CPAR, however, this new regime generally became effective for partnership tax years beginning after December 31st, 2017. This means IRS audits of partnerships will begin this year following this new CPAR procedure. At the federal level, CPAR changes the default rules for partnerships so that the IRS will collect tax at the partnership level on partnership adjustments, unless the partnership elects to use certain procedures and push out those adjustments to the partners. So, and again, under the old procedures, the old TEFRA, the partners paid the tax, not the partnership. So having the partnership pay is a big change in federal procedure. Oregon law was drafted using the under the TEFRA era, not CPAR. So under Oregon law, partnership generally did not pay income tax to Oregon, except in the limited case of these electing large partnerships that chose to pay at the partnership level, which that has since been repealed with CPAR. So Oregon needs to catch up with the repeal of TEFRA and the adoption of CPAR. We love our acronyms, right? Without House Bill 2101, the individual partner in a partnership in a CPAR audit might not receive an adjustment that the partner would otherwise be required to report to Oregon, because it was given to the entity, not the individual. And the partnership also would not have to pay tax to Oregon, even if the partnership had to pay IRS tax, additional IRS tax, because Oregon law currently, as it's currently drafted, wouldn't require the entity to report to us. Oregon is not alone in needing to adopt these procedures and catch up with CPAR. In 2016, the Multi-State Tax Commission, we know as MTC, formed a partnership project group consisting of industry, states, including, of course, Oregon, and staff from the MTC to discuss how the states would adapt to these new procedures. The intent of the group was to develop and adopt a model uniform statute and accompanying regulations that pertain to the reporting of these federal partnership audit adjustments. From 2016 to current, the MTC has hosted countless national conference calls. Nikki's been in part of all of them, I'm sure, allowing for input from stakeholders. Several draft versions of the proposed statutes were presented. The MTC hearing officer finally presented her final report in October of 2018, and they literally just voted to adopt it a week ago on January 24th. So the MTC has adopted their model proposal. House Bill 2101 generally follows the MTC model regarding partnership adjustments. The MTC model also included other broader changes that would apply to all taxpayers that get audited by the IRS, not just those related to partnerships. So those broader changes are not included in House Bill 2101 for a variety of reasons. Oregon already has statutes and rules that pertain to audit adjustments. When we receive information from the IRS that there's an adjustment, or if the report is from another state taxing authority, including a statute of limitations for either us assessing tax or the taxpayer claiming a refund. So those broader statutes apply to several tax programs, including the personal income tax, corporate income tax, fiduciary tax. Basically, every tax program we have is going to be affected by those broader rules, and we're not prepared to change that. In addition, sometimes it may it shortens the time frame in the MTC model for taxpayers claiming a refund. It shortens the period for us to issue deficiencies. So we're not prepared to bring those broader changes on right now. We want to limit our scope to just the partnership changes. So House Bill 2101 accomplishes a change to Oregon law to allow us to do that. But instead of the federal default of the partnership pays, the partnership pays and if the partnership makes an election in Oregon. And the reason for that is because the federal government does not have to deal with nexus issues, apportionment issues, or residency issues. So they still have to work on the assumption that they're going to be paying the tax at the individual level, but the partnership can elect up to pay at the partnership level. And that is what the MTC model recommends. And I think every state but California so far that has adopted this has done. California pushed out, did the federal rules just straight up, and the other states did not. They're all following the MTC model. So I am prepared to go over a section by section review of the bill if you prefer. I will leave it to you. I know it's like so. I will skip that then. But I do want to point out that
thank you for being so perceptive.
I thought I'd give you the choice. So there are technical amendments since the bill was drafted, and our legislative council has done an amazing amount of work on this bill. It's highly complex, but we have continued to look at the draft since she drafted it, and I think it was in October when we received it. And we know that there are still some technical amendments to make. I think COST has them outlined in their testimony as well. But we've worked with the stakeholders, the Multi-State Tax Commission, DOJ, the Department of Justice, and Legislative Council, and found ways that we can improve the bill. For example, the MTC model addresses other state adjustments, but we really only want to make adjustments to the Oregon return based on federal adjustments. Because, again, because of nexus apportionment and residency issues. So we want to clarify that. Another example is that the name of the federal notice needs to be conformed in the statute, so among other technical issues. So we're prepared to submit amendment language to Legislative Council if you approve. But with that, I'm happy to take any questions. We have experts in the room. If you have any technical questions that I can't get to, I can't answer. But I really appreciate you hearing me today, and I hope you support our efforts at aligning with federal law in House Bill 2101. Thank you.
Example of the kind of bill to schedule after everyone's had a good breakfast. If they're used to caffeine, have had their coffee, and it's in the morning, and I hope that we never hear a bill like this at like 2:30 in the afternoon.
True. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Nikki Dovey with the Council on State Taxation. We are here in support of House Bill 2101 with certain technical amendments, and I will outline those. For those of you who are not aware of COST, we are a nonprofit member organization, a national organization. We have over 550 members that are multi-jurisdictional taxpayers. So this is a very important issue for our membership. Because when our members get audited at the federal level, instead of just reporting it to one or two states, they have to report any federal change in numerous jurisdictions, every income tax jurisdiction that they file in. So that can be hundreds of filings for them. So the issue of reporting federal changes didn't just come up in 2015 after the passage of the Bipartisan Budget Act. It's something they've been dealing with for a long, long time. So that is just a little bit of history as to why COST got involved with the MTC working group after the Bipartisan Budget Act was passed and this working group came about. In addition to COST, there were several other national organizations that worked on this model. Just to name them, the Tax Executives Institute, the AICPAs, American Bar Association, State and Local Tax Committee, Institute for Professionals in Taxation, and the Master Limited Partnership Associations. Together, COST with these organizations have become known as the interested parties, and we played a large part in the drafting of this model at the MTC. And as Deanna said, that has now been officially adopted by them. The working group will probably get back together this spring and start working on regulations. There are certain provisions of the model that we left a bit more open-ended or vague, knowing that states would want to handle them differently, and also knowing that a lot of the technical ways in which these changes would be reported could be handled by regulation. So there will still be additional work done, and I'm sure the department will be working on those as well. But we do endorse or support House Bill 2101. The department has done an incredible job of taking the model and adapting it to Oregon law. You know, some folks think that the MTC can write a model statute and you can kind of just plunk it right down into any state and it'll work. Turns out that's not how it works. So they've gone through a lot of hoops to take what's in the model and adapt it to Oregon law and have done a fairly good job, but we do have a few technical issues we need to work on. We need to nail down what in the model is referred to as the final determination date, and we've been talking with the department on this issue, and we'll continue to have conversations to make sure that we set a date that the partnerships know, they understand when their reporting period begins, and they can comply. There's also references in Oregon law to tax matters partners. As of 1/1/18, that concept goes away. So we really do need to work on those old provisions that make those references to now pull those into the new CPAR law. It's also unclear how tax-exempt entities would be treated in the model. They pay tax at a 0% rate because they're tax exempt. And we just need to clarify that that is how it works in Oregon. Or if you're taking a different position, that that policy is addressed by this committee. And then finally, there's some vagueness as to what information certain taxpayers would need to determine certain allocations for non-residents and indirect partners. So I think we just either need to clarify that that will be addressed by rule or make that more clear in the statute. So with those technical amendments, we are very supportive of this effort. As Deanna said, this is something that many states have to address. There's only been a handful of states that have addressed this issue. Georgia is a state which has mostly addressed or adopted the model. They, however, used a prior version of it, so they may have a little bit more work to do. We do know that there are several other states considering legislation this year, and California did adopt legislation last year, which looks different than the model on its face. However, it incorporates many of the same concepts. The interested parties also worked with the Franchise Tax Board in California. So there is definitely parity between California's legislation that was adopted and the model. And so we encourage Oregon to be ahead of the pack on this and take the initiative to address them, to adopt the model. We would also encourage this committee to consider those broader changes in the model. Again, for multi-jurisdictional taxpayers, when there is a change at the federal level, it is a complex web that they have to figure out to report these changes. And really, one of the goals was this, with this model was that the more states that can adopt the provisions in the model for all taxpayers, the more uniformity that creates and the more efficiency that creates. That means that taxpayers can get the states the money they owe them after a federal change more quickly because they don't have to figure out, you know, 50 different rules. So we would encourage you to take a look at applying the definition of final determination date from the model for all taxpayers to clarify certain reporting periods. There are de minimis provisions in the model. These would be very good to not, if you aren't even going to consider, you know, looking at changes, addressing the changes for other taxpayers. Considering this for partnerships, this would allow, you know, if somebody's going to report a $10 change in tax, does the department want to process that change? So that would provide some flexibility for both the department and taxpayers, again, providing efficiencies. We also believe that Oregon could adopt a provision that would allow them to accept estimated payments. Again, this would allow the department to get money sooner where a change may be coming and a taxpayer wants to stop interest from running. So we are happy to engage in conversations with anyone on those issues as well, but we see this as a real opportunity for Oregon to make some significant changes for uniformity.
Your testimony. Ms. Mack, you indicated that you would appreciate being able to work on an amendment, and I will assume that if you do indeed work on that, that Ms. Dobay's comments, those categories of changes, would also be considered by you.
Yes, ma'am. We will consider them, yes.
Is there a discussion or questions from the committee? Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you both for that. And I clearly have been on this committee for long enough because I was able to follow everything that you said. So
yay.
I just wondered if the CPAs were involved in the discussions as well. I kind of assumed they were, but I figured I would call them out.
Madam Chair and Representative Smith-Warner, they actually provided testimony and support as well.
Great.
The AICPA as well as the Oregon Society of CPAs support the changes, and they've been involved.
Great.
The AICPA was one of the, Jonathan Horn of the AICPA is one of the primary drafters of the model.
Great, thank you.
Any questions or discussion? Thank you both. I'm closing the public hearing on 2101. I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2102. Oh, you're still
I'm
here.
Getting rid of that giant file. All right. House Bill 2102, for the record, I'm Deanna Mack with Department of Revenue, and House Bill 2102 is another one of the department's concepts, and it is related to disclosure for fraud prevention for our income tax programs. Right now, we have statutes that protect taxpayer information, and another statute that says the department can share information in certain circumstances. And we're looking to amend that statute because we would like to participate in part of the IRS Security Summit. It's a group called the Identity Theft Tax Refund Fraud Information Sharing and Analysis Center, coined as ISAC.
Yes. I wonder what the acronym
is. Yes, I was waiting for it.
There's another acronym. I'm full of those today. Right now, we're a limited partner in a participant in the ISAC and the IRS Security Summit because of the fact that the tax return information is confidential. But as part of this, what we get right now is we get what's called industry leads from software vendors that tell us that a particular return is highly suspected of being fraudulent. And so as part of the an expectation of getting these leads is that when we identify what we think is fraudulent information, we share it with those other states. It's a national effort to get ahead of these, what we call fraudsters. And so IRS, software companies, and other states are all very, very involved in this. But because our disclosure statutes don't allow that information sharing, we are only able to be a limited partner. If we do change our statutes and allow us to be a full participant, we will be able to see information. We will receive information that is specific to the department or to Oregon taxpayers, and they will be packaged daily so that we get this information in a timely manner so we can combat fraud as best we can. And then we can give information back to the software companies or the IRS through this ISAC group by letting them know whether the lead that they provided was fruitful or not. And that helps the entire country be smarter at fighting identity theft and fraud and tax returns. So to do that, we need to change our disclosure statutes. And I think it's very broad. It's not very broad. It's very narrowly crafted to make sure that it is, did I not print the bill? To make sure that it is, here it is. I think it says it's a multinational, multi-state group. Let me find it. I apologize for not having this put together properly. A multi-jurisdictional information sharing organization formed with oversight by the Internal Revenue Service to combat identity theft and fraud if the Department of Revenue is a member of the organization, and tax preparation software vendors that are a member of an organization described in that paragraph. So while it sounds like it's very broad, it really is just kind of spelling out this group that we are part of in the IRS Security Summit in ISAC. And so with that, if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them. But I would really hope that you guys could support our bill and pass it through this session.
Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so I'm kind of a data privacy hawk. And so when I hear data sharing, I'm always wondering what happens if an error is made or a mistake is made and somebody's information is mistakenly shared, or it was thought to be fraud, but then it's shared to this organization and it triggers some investigation that ends up being nothing, but then there's time and expense of the individual or the corporation that's been flagged this way. What kind of safeguards or protection is in this arrangement?
Madam Chair, Representative Reschke, there are pretty substantial safeguards in who can access the information, who can participate. When you're talking about somebody who mistakenly gets identified, that does happen from time to time, and we have edits in our system to prevent or show us what with high confidence that we know that your return is your return. And when our confidence levels drop, that's when they get involved. So there's something that's not appearing to be correct on the return. As far as the actual sharing of the information, in order to even access the information, there's only a couple of people within our agency, within the agency, the participating agencies. And when they log in, their passwords are changing constantly. And when they log in to even try and do this exchange of information, they, not only do they have to be on like Skype, but they also have to show photo ID. So it's very narrow who can even access this information. And it's also, the information that is shared is based on the fact that we believe it's got a low confidence of being the right person or the right information, and that's why it gets shared. And that's why it's so important to be able to share this information back so that we know, yeah, actually this was that person and we're all good. And so next year we won't have these issues. So it's really a taxpayer protection thing. We wanna make sure that those refunds get to the taxpayers that are entitled to those refunds and not some fraudster somewhere in another part of the world. So, does that answer your question?
It does.
Okay,
thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Madam Chair, I think there's also testimony from, I believe, H&R Block online in support of this because they're a participant in this as well. So, I want to draw your attention to that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And there appears to be no one else wanting to testify. I'm going to close the public hearing.
Thank you.
On 2102, and now I am opening a public hearing on House Bill 2103, Homestead Property Tax Deferral Program.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. HB 2103 is a measure that regards the senior and disabled homeowner deferral program, sometimes called the Homestead Deferral Program, which is set to expire in 2021. So it addresses the sunset and removes the sunset in the program. The program currently doesn't have a process for late filing or definition and a process for late filing. So the measure also establishes a late filing deadline and a process for what would happen if somebody were to to enter the program after that late filing. So there's a fee and an order of priority of applications up to the maximum number of applications for the program. And it also establishes that the local governments get to retain the interest accrued on delinquent accounts that were after August 15th in the first year of delinquency. So I think the Department of Revenue is here to talk about the bill as well.
Do we have a sign-up sheet for testimony?
Yes, I'm sorry.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Mr. Garst.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, Mark Garst with the Department of Revenue. House Bill 2103 comes to you at the request of the governor on behalf of the Department of Revenue. The Property Tax Deferral Program for Disabled and Senior Citizens is a program that's intended to benefit lower income folks and to help them to pay their annual property taxes. The way the program works is that you apply. If you qualify, we'll put a lien on the home and then we'll pay your property taxes going forward. If you are disabled or if you are disqualified from the program, the payments are then repaid with interest and a few little fees for recording and whatnot, and then we release the lien on your home. So there are three issues with the program that we're looking at this year. First of all, it's scheduled to sunset, as Jamie said. The bill would remove the sunset entirely. So it had a 10-year sunset previously, and the bill would just take the sunset away. Now, I know that you folks may have a different idea, and that'd be just fine. If you want to extend it for 10 years to ensure that you'll have a look at this program occasionally, you can certainly do that. But my experience is that there is not a session, certainly not a long session, where we don't have a robust conversation around senior deferral. I think that there are probably four bills out there right now that we'll be hearing about during the session possibly. So So that may or may not be a concern for you, but our bill would eliminate the sunset altogether. That was the direction that the agency chose through our agency policy committee. Additionally, the program currently has an April 15th application deadline, and it is a hard deadline. I often get calls. Often these are constituent calls that come through your offices where folks get their bill in October, and that's when they realize that they are not able to pay that property tax bill. We don't have anything that we can do for them. What I've literally told folks in the past is, if this is the first year that you can't pay, the county will not foreclose on your home. But if you, if you don't pay, you're going to accrue some significant interest on that 1 year, and then we'll be able to get you into the program next year. So this would stop that from being the solution, and instead folks would have an ability to file late as December 1st. So the bill includes a late filing penalty. We want to encourage people to file timely. It works a lot better if we do these all together, but at the same time, we want to have this ability. So the late filing penalty is 10% of the prior year's tax, and it can range between $20 up to $150. So that is the penalty that we came up with. The third thing that the bill does, counties, they have a little consternation around having to repay us when they take the property in a county tax foreclosure. When you do a county tax foreclosure, most liens are just wiped out. We're an exception, and the county repays us the full balance due. The counties have talked to us about this over the years, and this bill does give them a little bit of relief. It waives some interest, only the interest between the date when the property became delinquent and the date that they take the property in a county tax foreclosure. So that would be maybe 3 years or so of interest that we would be waiving for the county. We've worked with the county tax collectors, the county assessors, the Oregon State Bar, and a number of other folks through the process of developing this concept. We've heard some concerns. The one concern was certainly that they didn't think that there should be a late filing penalty. And again, the reason that we're doing that is because administratively, it's much more efficient if we can get folks to file timely. The second concern that we've heard is just, again, the counties do not like having to repay the full amount of the lien at the time that they take these in a county tax foreclosure. This gives them some relief, but I certainly know that there are folks out there who would like to see more relief. I would hope that you could support the bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Garst, for being here, as always. When you said that about interest, it just made me curious. How do you set the interest that you charge on these liens? Like, sure. Is it just prime rate? Is it?
It's a flat rate. I'm sorry, Chair Nathanson, Representative Smith Warner. It's a flat rate. It's 6%, and it's calculated simple interest. It's not compounded interest. Right now, we're not competitive with the best mortgage rates that are out there necessarily. But again, we target folks who are lower income, folks who maybe couldn't qualify for another mortgage. And so I don't think that it's unreasonable. Now, as rates go up, we'll become more competitive, which might drive some more people into the program. If you look at the last 20 years, certainly, we're very competitive. That 6% rate doesn't change. It doesn't go up when the prime rate goes up.
If I can confirm, and that's in statute or in rule?
Chair Nathanson, Representative Smith Warren, that's in statute.
Okay, thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So typically when you deal with tax credits and repealing a sunset, it resets it for 6 years, but this is a total repeal, so there would be no sunset going forward. Is that correct?
Chair Nathanson, Representative Reschke, yes, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
And the prior sunset was 10 years on this program, okay. Unlike the what you're
typical
talking about, the normal
six.
Six-year.
Right, okay. Thank you.
We can change that. Other questions? Okay. Discussion? Anyone else signed up to testify? I'm closing the public hearing then on House Bill 2103.
Sorry, I just wanted to understand it. I know.
I get what you want to. I'm now opening an informational meeting on assessor funding. Will you introduce the topic for us? Just a sentence or two, and you guys go.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. The county assessors are here to talk about the methods of funding for the local governments. And I think the Department of Revenue is giving an updated report.
Thank you. Ms. Warren, would you like to begin?
Good morning, Chair Nathanson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Susan Morgan. I work for the Association of Oregon Counties and do revenue issues for them. We wanted to talk to you, give you some background on CAFA this morning. And we also have in the audience Tom Rolfing, who is the Marion County Assessor, who can answer questions that you have that we don't have the answers to. So let me begin. I want to take you through the history of CAFA. And the history of CAFA funding started in the 1980s. And that was a harrowing time for those of you that remember back to it. Oregon and the rest of the nation had weathered a recession that was brought on as the Federal Reserve raised interest rates to curb inflation that was out of control in the national economy. It's hard to imagine under today's interest rates, but double-digit interest rates were the norm back then. This dramatically increased the cost of borrowing. It quickly crashed the national housing market. And in Oregon, not only the home building industry crashed, but so did the timber industry, which played a much greater role in Oregon's overall economy than it does today. In addition, the Northwest Forest Plan was implemented to accommodate the listing of the spotted owl, and timber harvesting on federal lands decreased dramatically. This hit counties hard, especially rural counties that funded their operations from shared harvest receipts. To deal with the dire financial straits that counties were experiencing in their ability to fund assessment and taxation, the 1989 legislature passed a bill that established the County Assessment Function Funding Assistance Account, CAFA. There were two revenue feeds. First was a percentage of interest on delinquent property taxes, and second were the proceeds from a document filing fee on property ownership transfers. The legislation set 90% of the revenue generated to counties in proportion to their approved budgets for A&T, and it sent the remaining 10% to the Department of Revenue to pay for industrial property tax appraisal, which had previously been done by the counties. It also added a prohibition on local governments imposing any new or increased fees or taxes on the transfer of real property, and it included a sunset date that gave this program a 10-year trial run and directed the Department of Revenue to come back to the legislature with a report. The discussion at that time was that CAFA would cover 35%, and I believe your research shows 32% of the cost to county administration of the property tax system. So somewhere in there. The program actually only fully funded the operations during the 01-02, 02-03, and 03-04 biennium. So 10 years later, the 97 legislature responded to DOR's report and increased the amount of interest revenue on delinquent property taxes that was transferred to CAFA, continued the prohibition on the local transfer taxes, and then directed another study to come back to the legislature. So in 1999, the legislature responded to the DOR report by increasing the document recording fee to $10 and greatly increasing the number of documents, the types of documents that were covered, and dedicated $1 of that $10 fee to go to the Department of Revenue to develop a base mapping system. It made permanent the preemption on local real estate transfer taxes and fees, and it also appropriated $5 million of general fund to to assessment and taxation. The legislature continued to appropriate general fund to CAFA from 1999 through 2008. By 2008, timber counties were in financial crisis because of the loss of the federal forest payments. Governor Kulongoski appointed the task force on federal forest payments and county services, and the final report contained three recommendations: to place all delinquent interest into the CAFA fund, to increase the state general funding for A&T, and to raise the $9 recording fee for A&T to $15. The 2009 session, which is probably fresh in most of your minds, was dominated by the Great Recession, dealing with the mortgage crisis across the nation and the fiscal challenges that that presented to you in this process. During the 2009 session, the general fund to support to CAFA was taken out of the budget, and there was no recommendations that were enacted related to the governor's task force recommendations, and there was no action taken until 2015 on CAFA funding. And in 2015, just over $1.8 million was appropriated to the Department of Revenue to backfill a forecasted revenue shortfall in CAFA caused by a decline in mortgage refinancing activities and lower recording fees. No corresponding backfill was provided to counties. There has been no legislative action since 2015. For 2018, the latest date that statistics are available, counties currently retain 16% of the property taxes that they collect for schools and all of the other local taxing districts. So statewide, for 1718, counties get 16%, K-12 and ESDs get 42% of the collections, cities get 21%, special districts, including service districts, get 14%, community colleges 4%, and urban renewal 4%. So one of the things that is particularly troubling to some counties is that Measure 50, when it was acted, imposed permanent tax rates. And there are a group of counties, the timber counties essentially, that weren't raising their base rates at that time because they were receiving this very robust feed of revenue from timber harvesting on federal lands. So some counties have tax rates that are far below the average. So the Curry County is just under 7%. Josephine at 9, Douglas at 9, Hood River at 10, Coos 11, Lane 12. And at the heart of this issue for counties, especially timber counties that have very low permanent tax rates, is the challenge of keeping the property tax system current while they're balancing the need for other critical services like sheriff's patrol, jail, prosecution, public works, and social services. I thank you for your attention and am happy to answer any questions. And I know my compadre here has some information that you're going to be interested in also.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, again, for the record, Mark Arst with the Department of Revenue. So thank you very much for that, Susan. That was a good little kind of roundup of how we got here. I'm going to hit you with some pictures and kind of try and tell the story a little visually. Here's the issue that we're dealing with. The red line is what the costs are as reported to the Department of Revenue from the various counties to maintain their effort on assessment and taxation. We call it A&T for short. This is the appraiser's office, tax collector, that type of thing. As you can see, over time, the revenues down at the bottom, the blue line, have been flat, but the costs have experienced inflationary increases. And so what this means is that the counties have had to cover a greater and greater share of that cost themselves.
I would like to interrupt and ask you to spend just a sentence or two telling us what goes into that cost. It's not just one person sitting at a desk. So paint a picture for us of what's involved in
Sure.
the county's responsibility.
Sure, absolutely. Well, we have Tom Rolfing here, and I'm sure that he could give you a good rundown of what his office looks like. But typically what you're looking at is a number of appraisers. That's one of the first functions of the assessor's office. They need to appraise the property so that they can establish what the value is for tax purposes. They have mapping programs there where they, you know, they divide the property into accounts. They need to tie that to a physical location. And so there will actually be quite a few folks that do mapping. The legislature loves to create property tax exemptions here and there. And so a lot of their work is actually administering those exemptions. We have a personal property tax on business property in Oregon. There will often be a section of the office where they deal with that activity. They have a tax collector office. Those are the folks who will send you your bill in October usually. They take the checks when you send the checks in. They process all of that. And then when you're not paying your taxes timely, those are the folks who will send you a letter and try and get you onto the right page. So I think that those are a few of the functions.
Thank
but
you.
That's it's quite a bit of work. It is a, it's a big lift for sure.
So if I might add, one of the other aspects of this is that as a former county commissioner myself, the one of the ways that we tried to gain economies was by using electronics, putting as much as we could in online and use the computer systems to do a lot of the work. And so the IT investment in assessor's departments is significant also.
Thank you. Question? Yes, a question from Representative.
Thank you, Chair. Do we, so the line that's rising on this chart shows how much we're spending. That doesn't necessarily have a direct correlation in terms of how much we need to spend or what the needs are out there. So the question is, are there markers that would indicate for a county in terms of population or property sales or anything like that, kind of what they should be able to provide to do the work adequately?
Chair Nathanson, Representative Marsh. So the at the Department of Revenue, so first of all, this information comes from CAFA applications. Mm-hmm. So the county reports to us how much it is that they're spending. They let us know their staffing levels and that type of thing. In order to receive that CAFA grant, the counties have to meet standards for minimal adequacy. I'll tell you, it's a pretty low bar. It includes things like sending the bills out, putting a value on the roll, making sure that exempt property is exempted, those kind of basic functions that an assessor's office absolutely has to do. We make sure that they're doing that type of thing. The Department of Revenue, excuse me, has a staffing model where we've kind of looked at what amount of effort we think it takes in a county. I'll tell you that right now we're talking about revising that staffing model. It certainly needs some work, but you know, we look at things like number of accounts in the county and that sort of metrics in order to determine how much work it might be. The International Association of Assessing Officers, they've done some looks at this type of thing as far as what level of effort is typically required across multiple jurisdictions. But as you're aware, Oregon, very different property tax system than any place else in the United States. And so as far as what the need is, does that help a little bit?
I assume we will talk more about this over the course of the next few months as we delve into it.
So continuing on, so CAFA currently the split as far as where the money's coming from is delinquent property tax interest at 62%, recording fees at 37%, and then we have some interest-bearing accounts that are less than a percent. When the economy's bad, we might get a little bit more from delinquent interest. When the economy's good, we might see some more recordings. But as you can see here, the blue line, overall, it's not increasing. The fund has been relatively flat over many, many years. So not a revenue source that's growing along with costs. 10% of CAFA goes to the Department of Revenue. So the line here that you see, the blue line, this is just the distributions to the counties. Recently, CAFA's been a little bit over $20 million, $2 million to the department, $18 million a year to the counties. That's basically how it gets split up. The way it gets split up to the counties is based off of the relative sizes of their budgets. So if you're a county that spends more on assessment and taxation, you get more CAFA, and it is just straight prorated. So 27%, I think, was the last number I saw, goes to the three big counties that spend the most on assessment and taxation. As Susan indicated, there was a time when CAFA covered as high as 32% of costs, and these days we're down to about 17% of the county cost being covered by CAFA. At the state level, As Susan said, we've come to the legislature again and again at the property tax division of the Department of Revenue and asked for general fund backfill. And we've had mixed results with that, but the legislature has stepped up and helped us out sometimes. So next slide is staffing. So we receive information from the counties as a part of the CAFA application process about their staffing levels. We confirm this information by going back, having conversations, looking at the organizational charts. And these are the actual staffing numbers for all the counties taken together, full FTEs. So you can see on the left, that is actually the number of bodies that we're talking about, 940 folks in 1998. Now we're down to a much lower number. We're down to 836. So since the high that you see there, which was 2006, we had about 957 folks then. We're down to 836. So that's a 12.7% decrease in county staffs for this type of work. Some counties have done better than others. You know, I think Susan covered that pretty well.
Can we go back to that other slide? I'm going to jump in with a question here. Sometimes technology helps replace what it took four people to do. Now all of a sudden you can get it in 8 minutes on a computer or something. But I'm assuming that a technology it is not substituting for staff in certain functions, such as actually going out to view a property or analyzing something based on information that you're receiving, either in writing or photographs or whatever it is. So could you help me understand how much IT might replace the need for staffing? And since there's so much less staffing, what doesn't get done? If it's not replaced by technology helping people do something faster, which part of the functions it just has to be, you have to give up entirely or it becomes delayed, backlogged?
Sure.
Should we ask Tom to come up?
Well, I think I can kind of
in general, yes.
As far as how much does technology help, mm-hmm. That would be a very hard thing for me to actually give you a number on, but I think that our hope would be that you do have technology, you increase your efficiency, and it gets you to get out and do more field work, which is one of the primary ways that we actually find property that needs to go on the roll is that you go out, the assessor's office knocks on doors, they will hang a knocker if they're not there. They're looking to see what things you might have done to your property since the last time that that they were out there. Additionally, they go out and pursue pursue permits is another thing that is like a really big way that we bring property onto the roll. But, people don't always pull permits. I have, at the end of the presentation, I have quite a bit about some of the issues that we think are out there, things that are not getting done.
Okay.
I can talk about them now or we can...
No, I'll wait.
Okay.
Thank you.
But I wish I had, I agree completely that technology does, in some ways, alleviate the need for staff. But, our system... with more exemptions that we pass, it becomes more complex. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of work out there that's not getting accomplished.
There's plenty that technology doesn't do.
Sure. So here are the county permanent rates. As Susan described them, Measure 50 established these permanent rates based on what the county budgets were at the time. And a lot of the counties weren't doing as much property tax at that time because they were getting all those timber revenues. The timber revenues went away, but the permanent rates didn't change. They're still what they were. So that puts some of these counties, a lot of times they're referred to as the ONC counties, it puts them in a position where they're less able to make up for the loss of that revenue as far as the funding of their assessor offices. So some of your larger counties, they've done a great job of keeping up. Some of those counties are on a good reappraisal cycle. They're doing an excellent job out there, and their staffing levels have not really, had a problem. Other counties, unfortunately, we don't see that to be the case. So this next graph shows staffing at counties that have a permanent rate of less than $2. And so as you can see here, the staffing decreases are even more stark. Since 2007, they've seen a 20% decline in these 13 counties as far as the number of staffing that they have. So it'd be interesting to look and see which of these counties got new computer systems since 2007. I doubt that it's that many of them, frankly. I think that when times were good, when the economy was great, counties were making a significant investment into their assessor's offices. But as times have gotten tight, everybody's had to tighten their belts, and this is the decline that we've seen. Not just the counties are experiencing this, as we kind of alluded to, the Department of Revenue. We've also seen significant staffing decreases. Our workforce has gone from 125 folks in 2005 to 90 positions in the current year. We're actually holding vacancies right now. Some of those positions are partially funded, and we're holding some vacancies in order to balance our budget through the end of the biennium. The impacts are out there. We know that. We think that money is being left on the table, frankly. We don't think that we're collecting everything from this property tax system that we should be collecting. When there's inadequate staffing, Oregonians don't necessarily pay their fair share of taxes to support schools, police, fire, and other governmental services, including schools. I will tell people all the time, nobody likes taxes. Taxes are one of the worst things out there. But the only thing that's worse than having to pay taxes is knowing that you're paying your share and the person next door isn't necessarily paying their share. And I think that that might be the situation that we've gotten into by leaning so much on voluntary compliance. So how could property escape taxation? First of all, folks do a lot of additions, remodels, and whatnot to their house without pulling permits. We know that that happens quite a bit. And the only way that you actually see that that work's been done, that that garage has been converted to a bedroom and whatnot, is by actually going out and physically looking at these properties. The omitted property statutes allow the assessor to capture current year plus five prior years of taxes when they find something. But some of these counties are on a 20-year reappraisal cycle right now, so they may not see the property for many, many years before they actually pick this new improvement up. And that means that there might be value that will never be captured, that they'll never actually get. When they do pick the property up, it's on the roll, and that value continues on into the future. So it builds on itself. So there's a real advantage to getting this property onto the roll. Not all improvements require an increase in your maximum assessed value. You can do up to $10,000 in 1 year or $25,000 over 5 years, and that doesn't count to increase your maximum assessed value. And you can also do like-for-like replacement without having that increase your maximum assessed value. So not everything counts. Another area where we think that there are some issues is underfiled or underreported business, real, and personal property returns. So in 2017, the state funded a little pilot project. It's called the Southern Oregon Consortium. They went out and they looked for folks who were not filing personal property returns. That project turned up in a year and a half. They turned up $191,000 a year in taxes, and they estimate that the real benefit was closer to $550,000, because as soon as it hit the paper that they were going to be going out and looking for these accounts, they had people coming to them before they had even sent out a letter saying, hey, I saw this article in the paper. I have some personal property that I need to report. Again, many of the counts that they found were below the threshold. So if your value of all your business personal property is less than 16.5, you're not required to pay taxes on that. So not everything out there is going to be picked up. Another area we think is underreported industrial property. The Department of Revenue, we appraise industrial facilities, manufacturing facilities over $1 million. We go out every year, get appraisers out into the field, and look for this type of property where folks have bought a new machine and they haven't reported it, where they've done something to their building and they haven't reported it. In 2017, we found over $64.5 million in omitted property value on our inspections. Currently, we're trying to get out to sites every 8 years. That's our target. But what we've had to do that is to appraise less and less accounts at those sites. Mm-hmm. So to hit that number, we're only looking at 42% of accounts. So we might go out, we might look at a real property account, we might look at the personal property, we might be looking at the buildings. We're going to go out there and at least get into the facility and make them know that, you know, that it's important that they file timely. We're going to look for new stuff, obviously. So that's another area where we think we could see property being left off the roll. Improper exemptions is another area. There are many exemptions where you don't have to file annually. There may have been a change in use at that property, and it may not have been picked up by the assessor. Without going out and actually looking at these properties that are exempt, you don't really know if you're picking up all the value that you should be. And then finally, undervalued property. Representative Smith made a comment the other day in a hearing about real market values being low. When I was in the private sector for many years as a real estate appraiser, I think that the feeling that we had was that the assessor's values were often 10% too low. That was kind of the rule of thumb that you would use when you would look at those. I don't know if that's actually accurate. We do take steps at the Department of Revenue to try and get the right real market value on the roll. We have what's called ratio reports. So we'll look at that class of property in that neighborhood. We'll look at things that have been selling for, and then we look at what values the assessor has on the roll, and then we'll do some trending related to that. But again, that's just trending. And if somebody built something new and you don't know about it, it's not going to increase the value the way that it should.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to share an example. My wife sent me a text yesterday of an appraisal that came back on one of my properties in Deschutes County. The real market value versus the new appraised value was a $180,000 difference.
The difference.
That's significant.
Significant. And that's brand new, fresh information. And so I do financing all the time, and it typically runs 25 to 40% difference between appraised value and real market value.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Gass, there was, and you need to help refresh my memory a little bit. The components that make up the funding for this come from recording fees. We passed a substantial recording fee increase last spring. Did that not help any?
Chair Nathanson, Representative Finley, that recording fee increase was dedicated for housing. So
no, it was targeted. I remember we raised it, but I can't remember all the hooks that went with it. The recording fee is not based on a percentage of total fees. It's capped. So we disallowed you to take advantage of that.
Yeah, Chair Nathanson, Representative Finley, the way that the recording fee statutes are written, I believe that it's like this number of dollars of the recording fee is dedicated for housing, this number of dollars of the recording fee goes to CAFA. So it's broken out that way. And again, just a little bit more on real market value. Everybody knows in Oregon we're taxed on the lesser of your maximum assessed value or your real market value. So there's not necessarily an increase if the real market value, if the assessor gets out and raises real market values. But it is important when you first appraise the property, that's what establishes the maximum assessed value. So it's very important there. It also determines whether or not you see a 3% increase in your maximum assessed value every year. Depends on what that real market value is. So it's an important component, and we certainly think that it's possible that some money is being left off the table there. Impacts, how much money are we talking about? I wish that I don't want to get Rumsfeldian on you. We don't know what we don't know, though. Honestly, it's very hard to say how much money is being left on the table. We've talked to assessors about this, and what I will say is I think that it's very different county to county. So again, you have some counties, they have a higher rate, they've had a better ability to keep their staffing levels up, and they maybe are doing a little bit better job of capturing most of that value that goes onto the roll. Washington County, for instance, they do regular audits of their personal property accounts. Not every county has that luxury right now. So we think it's significant. This is a system that generates $6.7 billion a year. And so it wouldn't have to be very much as a percentage in order for it to have a significant impact.
I've got a couple of questions that I'd like to get in before we adjourn, unless you have something. A last element that we haven't heard about yet.
No, I'll just close by saying that 42% of this money goes to schools, K through 12 and ESD. And so this is not just a local revenue issue. Because of the way that the school funding formula works, as Dave told you, that there's impacts for the general funds as well.
Thank you. My two questions. Do you already have information compiled on the reappraisal cycle for our 36 counties so that we could see who's caught up and who's behind or how much behind? I don't mean for today, but is it possible to get us some information that shows us the degree of the problem from one county to another. My other question is it possible to get us information either for all counties or just for those that you know? Who has automation that's fairly up to date and who has some processes not automated at all? They really need something, but they can't afford to buy it. It would be an investment, but a one-time expenditure. Sure, there's a little bit of, you gotta have people who maintain software, understand it, and implement it. But generally, I believe there is a way to look at a one-time investment. So which counties need something automated that isn't at all, or it's so old it needs to be replaced, versus other counties that seem to be fully automated and it's fairly new and things are perking along pretty efficiently?
We could work on that.
Thank you.
Yeah, Chair Nathanson, I would just say that prior to Measure 50, there was a requirement that there was a six-year reappraisal cycle, and as a part of Measure 50, that requirement went away. And so now what I've heard anecdotally is that counties can be anywhere from still trying to keep up on that six-year cycle to well over 20 years to no cycle at all. So the range is wide, but we can definitely do some looking at that.
Great. I think it would be good to have something, some objective data, and not rely on only on the anecdotal information. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to share one last thought on appraisal versus assessment. And I was hoping someone would call me out, but they didn't. An appraiser gets to go into a home and go in and see improvements that are made and carpet that's laid and windows replaced, where assessment doesn't have that option. And so I think it's important for us to understand with an appraisal, that's a science, where assessment is an art. And there's a lot of variations and outside factors that affect that. And so I want to defend our Department of Revenue and our counties. They do a good job. But to think that one is equal to the other isn't always accurate. But they do a great job.
So if I could just add to Representative Smith's comment. Also, we are looking at a mass valuation model when we do the appraisal of these properties for tax purposes. Whereas the appraiser that comes out to your house, he's looking at your individual property with three sales or whatever he's using, income approach, whatever he's looking at for the individual property. But for this is a mass appraisal model. And so it makes sense that some of the properties are gonna be on a little high, some of them are gonna be on a little low. You will come and tell us if the value is too high, but nobody comes to say my value is too low. It just does not happen.
Exactly. Any other questions or comments? Thank you very much for your presentation. Thank you. Legislative Revenue Office. We're adjourned.